Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Iran's new leader's condemnation of the Holocaust as a crime in an answer to a question from Christiane Amanpour, which the official Iranian Fars news agency later accused CNN of fabricating. Abbas Milani, an Iranian-American historian and author who is a visiting professor at the political science and director of the Iranian Studies Program at Stanford University, joins us to discuss the delicate balancing act Rouhani has in reaching out to the West while dealing with hardliners at home. And then we will speak with Sam Pizzagatti, who is a veteran labor journalist who has an article at inequality.org, Federal Regulators Finally Mind the Gap, which reveals a debate inside the Security and Exchange Commission over skyrocketing pay for America's CEOs in contrast to ordinary workers. After delaying debate on the pay ratio disclosure rule under the Dodd-Frank Act for 37 months, it has finally come up for discussion at the SEC, and we will look into the efforts of Wall Street-friendly commissioners who tried to defend the indefensible. Then finally, we'll go to the Lone Star State for an analysis of how far Senator Ted Cruz and his backers are prepared to take the country to the right, from Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas. With the Tea Party candidate using the media to grandstand and make headlines to please his backers, the Koch brothers and the Club for Growth, we will examine the extraordinary spectacle of an ambitious politician using the United States Senate as a fundraising platform for his planned run for the presidency in 2016. And joining us now is Abbas Milani, who's the director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and a professor in the Division of International Comparative and Area Studies. He's one of the founding co-directors of the Iran Democracy Project and, until 1986, taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he was also a member of the board of directors of the University's Center for International Relations. He's the author of The Shah and has an article at The New Republic, More Reason for Optimism About Iran's New President. Welcome to Background Briefing, Abbas Milani.
Thank you for having me.
And how does this paradox strike you, or this disconnect here, where in the interview at CNN with Christiane Amanpour, the new Iranian leader, Rouhani, in an answer to a question from hers, condemns the Holocaust as a crime, and then the Iranian Fars news agency later reports it and accuses CNN of fabricating the answer? Does that sort of point to the delicate dance that this leader is trying to do?
That's exactly the case, because it even predates a little bit these two interviews when the foreign minister sent the New Year welcome greetings to the Jews of the world. And then in the answer to Ms. Pelosi, the daughter of the, Nancy Pelosi, said that the man who denied the Holocaust is no longer here. Kayhan, the official paper that speaks for Khamenei, really lambasted him and made very, very serious anti-Semitic comments, saying that we do not take back what Ahmadinejad said, and we do deny that there was a Holocaust in really remarkably odious terms. And I think Mr. Rouhani, in his conservative, pragmatic way, decided to back down initially in the first interview, where he said, I'm not a historian, I'm a politician, as if only historians know about the Holocaust. And then in the second, he tried to fix his ways, but then backed down when he was attacked.
So the it's often stated by Western analysts of Iran that Rouhani, they've used the Nixon going to China analogy, that Rouhani has such close ties to the Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Quds, having been a former minister of intelligence, that he is the guy that can deliver the hardliners on some kind of compromise deal with the West. Do you buy that?
Well, yes and no. First of all, he never was a minister of intelligence. He was offered the job, but he was too clever to take it, knowing that in regimes like Iran, minister of intelligence has short-term power and long-term infamy. But he has close ties. He was in the military. He was a liaison with the Revolutionary Guards. And he has always tried to keep his bridges to virtually every faction. But I think the reason, I think the comparison with China is a little ill-advised, because what is driving, in my view, this newfound willingness to compromise is the very dire Iranian economy. And the regime recognizes that it's in a crisis mode, and it really has no choice but to try to at least seem to be compromising to hopefully get the sanctions lifted, to hopefully get the economy rolling, because otherwise they really have a serious major problem even making basic foodstuff available to the people, as they themselves admit.
So is this then a struggle between realists and pragmatists and ideologues on the right? In other words, are if these guys, like the new president, are trying to relieve the misery of the Iranian people from these sanctions to try and make a deal with the West to have them go away, are they likely to be overruled by the hardliners who live in a more ideological world?
Well, I think that's exactly the danger. The hardliners clearly have been badly rebuked in the last election. The number of votes that Rouhani got himself was larger than all the hardliners put together. So the hardliners have been defeated, but they have not given up because, first of all, this is a very lucrative gig for them. These are billions of dollars that they're fighting over. Even the most ideological fractions of this regime, like the Revolutionary Guards, are really fighting now more for a piece of the pie, the oil pie, than they are for ideology. They want to fight for control, a bigger control of the pie. And I think there are enough people within the regime who, as you suggest, have realized that the game is really serious, that they might lose the whole pie if they're not willing to share for a smaller piece, that they might not have, the conservatives might not have the power to really regain their lost power and divert the path that now Rouhani, many in the clergy, Rafsanjani, many in the IRGC Revolutionary Guards have decided to take. Just remember, half of this reformist cabinet that or semi-reformist cabinet that he has introduced are past Revolutionary Guard commanders who have parted company with the hardliners and think that this is the way to go to preserve the system.
Again, I'm speaking with Abbas Milani, the Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and a professor in the Division of International Comparative and Area Studies. He's one of the founding co-directors of the Iran Democracy Project and until 1986 taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he's also a member of the Board of Directors of the University's Center for International Relations. He's the author of The Shah and has an article at The New Republic, More Reasons for Optimism About Iran's New President. And you say in your article, Abbas Milani, that the Ayatollah Khamenei himself, the supreme leader, is the largest obstacle to reform, and he's tainted by his support for Ahmadinejad. Apparently, it was Ayatollah Khamenei who vetoed Rouhani's possible meeting at the UN with President Obama. So at the end of the day, when you say that the elections matter, the fact that this Hassan Rouhani got more votes than the rest of the hardliners combined, does the Ayatollah, the supreme leader, care about public opinion? And does he care about the fact that he's tainted by Ahmadinejad?
I think he is. He does care because power essentially requires some form of base and some form of strength. He does not have the unified support of the Revolutionary Guards, which was and is, I think, his main basis of support. There are increasing challenges to his authority within the clergy. There are increasing challenges even to his authority within the more radical, lunatic fringes of the Revolutionary Guards. And some of the commanders of the Revolutionary Guards, since Khamenei gave the go-ahead for what he calls a kind of resilience, a kind of heroic resilience, he calls it, in diplomatic negotiations, some of the radical fringe lunatic members have been saying some of the most remarkable, intransigent, challenging things, like we'll sink every ship the U.S. has in the Persian Gulf, that our resilience is, in fact, our pathway to destruction of Israel. This is said by the head of the Basij, the militia. So it is very, I think Khamenei has put himself in a very tenuous position. And he's trying to save face by making it, by making this silly, I think, gesture of not allowing this handshake, because the foreign minister is going to be sitting next to Kerry and having a discussion. And on every level, they are now in negotiations, have been in negotiations, and to forbid the handshake is, in my view, a kind of silly attempt to save face when there is no longer a face to be saved, and people consider him very responsible for Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad is the creation of Mr. Khamenei and was kept in power by Mr. Khamenei and none other.
So, Abbas Milani, when you say in your article at the New Republic, more reasons for optimism about Iran's new president, it does seem that much of his speech at the UN was directed at a domestic audience in Iran. It was vague in nature. It often had the accusatory tone that Ahmadinejad had throughout his speeches. And, of course, as you mentioned, he got meeting with Obama, got vetoed by the Supreme Leader. What is the – just in terms of this game that's being played here with presenting Iran, as he did in his speech, as the champion of democracy and wanting to renew a democratic movement against extremism and lead that movement. At the same time, you have people, I think there's more journalists in prison in Iran than any other country in the world, including China. We know about the crackdown of the Green Movement, the brutal suppression of that, etc. So how do they honestly believe? I mean, they do have – you've pointed out that votes count, and the fact that this guy got so many votes does affect his power base and gives him some leverage against the Supreme Leader. But at the end of the day, are these leaders cynical about the use of democracy, or do they really – are there people in that power structure who really want – real democracy in Iran?
Well, I think both of these statements are true in the sense that there are many, far too many, cynical leaders who sometimes clearly indicate that the vote of the people means nothing, that in Iran the only sovereign is God and his representative is Khamenei and everything else is secondary and tertiary. And there are others who are beginning to recognize that Iranian society has changed. Iranian society now has 4.5 million college students. It has about 12 million students. It's 60% of college graduates with science degrees are women. You can't rule that society with medieval ideas that I get divinations from God and must rule in his name and you have no business. And Rouhani, I think, is clever enough to know that that game is no longer tenable. But at the same time, he's cautious enough, he's cunning enough, he's Machiavellian enough not to want to challenge Khamenei directly. He has been, after all, Khamenei's representative for 20 years. I think in his heart of heart knows that the Khamenei rhetoric's days have ended in Iran, but he doesn't want to challenge him directly. And his UN speech fell flat, because they work too hard to create high expectations of it on the one hand. And on the other hand, you know, he had the pleasure of having very low standards to meet after the 8th truly embarrassing performance by his predecessor, Ahmadinejad. All he had to do not to embarrass himself was not to embarrass himself and say foolish things like Ahmadinejad. But then they created this really high PR push that this is going to be a game changer, that his appearance is going to be a game changer. And when the conservatives began to attack him and threaten him he backed down and delivered what was really a very lukewarm and very, I think, overly cautious and conservative, and as you say, in some ways, accusatory speech. And in some of the interviews, he, particularly in the first interview, I mean, I was truly shocked when, in the answer to Carney Chong's question about the Holocaust, he says, "I'm not a historian, I'm a politician," as if only historians know about the Holocaust and can say categorically that whoever has denied it is a fool.
But, of course, he said a different thing to Christian Amanpour.
Yes, exactly. I think he got a lot of heat from people who knew better. And it was very clear that there was in disarray between him and his foreign minister, who had clearly in a Twitter said that the man who denied the Holocaust is no longer there. And, you know, to get involved in this, and to be honest with you, I mean, as a response to that Twitter, as I said before, Kahan, the paper that supposedly speaks for Khamenei, wrote what I think is one of the most odious anti-Semitic editorials in recent memory in Iran, saying that, no, we don't deny the Holocaust. The Holocaust is a Jewish lie. I mean, these I'm almost verbatim quoting. I had the whole thing almost quoted in the New Republic article, but that space wouldn't permit it, so we had to cut some of it. And ends up by suggesting in the editorial that the only people who actually committed the Holocaust are Jews when they killed believers during the time of Muhammad. And to have that as your right flank in Iranian politics gives you a sense of the kind of tightrope walking that he's doing. But I think he miscalculated. I think he should have spoken more forthrightly. And I think that would have carried the day. And I don't think the conservatives are in a position right now to challenge him more. I think he's miscalculating how in disarray the conservative camp is and how desperate they are to find some respite from the economic sanctions.
Yeah, but they do have the guns, they have the militias, they have the prisons, they have the intelligence service, they have the military. So, I mean, how strong do you think is the green movement, as the Nobel laureates describe it, as the ashes burning under the embers?
I think the regime knows itself that it's ashes burning from the ember. First of all, this cabinet that Rouhani, in his absolute conservatism, in his brutal pragmatism, has put together is virtually a reformist group. Most of these people were openly sympathetic or parts of the reformist agendas of the past. The man who's replaced Rouhani in the National Security Council, Mr. Shamkhani, is on record as saying that the 2009 movement, which Khamenei calls a great sedition, was the great democratic movement of the Iranian people. So in one sense, they have been already rebuked. They have realized that the policy of torture, prison, illegal prison, I mean, they have the green movement's leaders, Mr. Mousavi, Mrs. Rahnavard, Mr. Kadroubi, now over 1,000 days in an illegal incarceration in their home. There's no indictment against them. They still don't dare release them, and they don't dare put them on trial. Does that mean that the Green Movement has been defeated? No. If a movement has been defeated, you're not this afraid of its leaders. If a movement has been defeated, you don't have to bring back many of the people who were considered your enemies till 4 months ago into key positions in the government.
Well, Abbas Milani, let's stay tuned and stay in touch, because obviously if the sanctions are removed and if the nuclear program is opened up, there could be some radical changes underway.
I hope so, and it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Abbas Milani, who's the Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and a professor in the Division of International Comparative and Area Studies. He's one of the founding co-directors of the Iran Democracy Project and until 1986 taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he's also a member of the Board of Directors of the University's Center for International Relations. He's the author of The Shah and has an article at The New Republic, More Reasons for Optimism About Iran's New President. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the SEC finally dealing with Dodd-Frank rules over the pay disparity between CEOs and ordinary workers.
Hey,